This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Doucet Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. How ready will you be for retirement? Our guest today says if you're like most Americans, the answer is not very ready at all. We're talking this hour with Andrew Eshtruth. For decades, he's studied retirement finance, first as a government official and for the past 15 years at Boston College's Center for Retirement Research. This week, he's in New Hampshire highlighting the huge holes he sees in terms of public policy and individual planning. We're long past what Eshtruth calls the golden age of retirement, where private pensions and Social Security created comfort and stability for many senior citizens. That world no longer exists, he says, but most Americans still don't realize how much money they'll need once they stop working, and so aren't taking the right steps now to set themselves up for a decent future. Today in The Exchange, becoming retirement ready. We'll look at the ideas in Eshtruth's new co-authored book. It's called Falling Short, The Coming Retirement Crisis and What to Do About It. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Andrew Eshtruth, it's good to see you. Good to have you here in New Hampshire. Welcome to the Granite State.
Thank you very much, Laura. Pleasure to be here.
Well, I did want to start with the title of your book, The Coming Retirement Crisis. And it seems to me the word crisis, Andrew, is used a lot these days, maybe even a little overused. What about this? Is it really a crisis?
So the way in which it's a crisis, and we like to think of it as a brewing crisis, it's not something that if you look around you today, you'll see tremendous suffering. When we say there's a brewing crisis, it's a situation that's gradually getting a little bit worse every year, a little bit more challenging for individuals approaching retirement age. And what we're really focused on is not whether people will have enough to eat. We're not worried about that. We're worried about whether they'll be able to have the kind of retirement that they would like to have. And we usually look at that by targeting whether they will have enough to maintain the standard of living they enjoyed before they retired.
So it's a crisis brewing, not necessarily, you know, imminent. It's going to crash over our heads immediately.
Correct.
So what are the big shifts, Andrew, that you and your co-authors see coming together all at once to create this situation, you know, crisis or not?
So there have been systematic changes in both demographics and in the economy that have led shifted risk and responsibility away from institutions like government and employers and toward individuals for retirement planning. And very quickly, a few of those, they're doing two things. One is that there's a need for more retirement income. And the reason people are going to need more income is they're living longer. Healthcare costs are rising rapidly, particularly for people at older ages. And interest rates are at record lows, real interest rates, which make it harder to draw income out of your nest egg when you're a retiree. So those are the forces that are driving the need for more income. On the other hand, the traditional sources of income like Social Security and employer pensions are going to provide less support relative to your pre-retirement earnings than they did for prior generations.
Yeah, and in the book you talk about the golden age of retirement. And I was surprised to read, actually, that it wasn't that long ago. What did that golden age look like?
That golden age was a period where if you had a good job, you probably had a traditional defined benefit pension, which paid you, sent you a check every month for life when you retired. That was a supplement to your Social Security benefit. So if you were a worker who'd been with the same company for 20 or 30 years and you retired, you didn't need much of a retirement planning strategy. I used to say people would go to their mailbox and they'd get two checks every month and cash them put them in the bank. That was all they needed. And that provided fairly comfortable living. People were able to retire at earlier and earlier ages over time, so that by 30 years ago, people were retiring in their early 60s.
So you mentioned just a minute ago that the responsibility used to be with big institutions, employers, and government providing this golden age that you just described. So what happened to that? Why was there this pullback from institutional responsibility to individual responsibility?
Looking at the employer side first, employers came to realize that these defined benefit pensions could be both expensive as lifespans increased, and they were on the hook to pay benefits for a longer period of time. And they really didn't like the volatility that would occur on their balance sheets. So when the stock market would go up or down, it would affect how much money they had to put into these pension plans to ensure that they would be funded down the road. And one of the things they pulled back from was the increased volatility that raised for their share prices and their shareholders. People don't like volatility in business. They like manageable costs.
So they weren't sure how much these would cost them down the road. They got big. They got expensive as people live longer. So businesses started to say, you know, we don't really want to do this anymore.
That's right. And it happened very quickly in a matter of decades.
I wonder also just on this private pension, because some people lament, you know, the loss of that. It's become a global economy. Companies need to compete with companies elsewhere around the world, not just within the United States. So I wonder how a company can continue to offer those gold-plated pensions, as they're called, when they're competing with a country that either doesn't offer them at all, or a country where there's a broad public welfare network, and so individual companies don't have to do it. The government's got it covered.
I think that's a good point, and you raise that broader social welfare network. Businesses in this country handle health care for their employees, and that's a cost that competes with other fringe benefit costs like pensions. So as healthcare costs have gotten more and more expensive, it's become even harder for them to be able to put more money into pensions.
And as more American workers move away from that model of staying with a company, you know, most or all their careers, again, the gold watch after 40 years, you know, thank you very much. How workable is this older model of a company pension when most workers, you know, shift jobs every 7 to 10 years?
We don't think that model is coming back in the private sector. You still see these types of pensions in the public sector, but even there, there's starting to be change. So we don't see that as a model that's coming back. And that's one reason why in the book we look at solutions. We don't focus on trying to bring back these pensions in some way. I think that's fading away into history.
So as nice as it was for that earlier generation, it's gone. Let's look at something else. The something else that seems to have replaced private pensions, and we'll talk about Social Security for sure in a moment, is 401ks. And just remind us, Andrew, how those work and how they're different from traditional pensions.
So 401ks are very simple. They're essentially like a savings account. When you sign up for a company with a 401k plan, usually the employer will match contributions that you put in from your own salary up to a certain level. And that money goes into an account. You usually choose from a menu of stock and bond mutual funds. And whatever is in that account at retirement is what you draw out. That difference with traditional pensions is that in traditional pensions, employers basically promise you a particular benefit when you retire based on your salary history and your years of service. And so when you retired under a traditional pension, the employer bore all the risks associated with providing that check every month.
So you get $1,000 a month no matter what.
That's right. And in the 401k world, you don't know what you're going to get until you retire, you look at your asset balance, and then you figure out how to manage it.
Yeah, and that requires a lot more financial literacy, which you say quite clearly in this book, Andrew, most Americans lack.
Most Americans do not have a high level of financial literacy. And to some extent, we don't think they need to have it. They need to know enough to know if they're moving in the right direction. But they have a lot of demands on their time. So we don't think the answer is largely you need to focus, have all these people, instead of doing other things with their free time, reading mutual fund prospectuses.
We don't think that's
the solution.
So how do you boost your financial literacy? But so you understand what you need to do for retirement, but not to the point where, you know, you're stressing out and spending all your time focusing on it.
Well, we think the best use of improving financial education would be, this is a good role for the employers, if employers point you in the right direction and then explain why they're pointing you in that direction. For example, through what we call an automatic 401k plan. they default you unless you make a different decision. They say, we're going to put you in the plan. We're going to put you in at a certain salary percentage. You can make different decisions if you like, but this is where you're starting, and we're going to put you in a certain mutual fund. Then education can be used on the part of the employer to explain why they made those choices and what other choices you might have instead.
So it's a default. You're automatically in unless you say, no, thank you.
Correct.
Do most people do that now, most companies?
Roughly half of companies, and it tends to be the larger companies who use this technique, roughly half have some sort of auto-enrollment plan that covers at least their new employees. It may not have been used for their existing workers. And these are very powerful, and we think it's a model that should be expanded.
Again, our phone number here in the exchange for you to join us as we talk about retirement and our guest's new book that he co-authored, Falling Short, The Coming Retirement Crisis and What to Do About It. Andrew Eshtruth is with us. Join us with your questions and comments. 1-800-892-6477. And Andrew, let's go to Kathleen in Peterborough. Hi, Kathleen. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Oh, good morning, Laura. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to call in because for the last 30 years, incomes coming in haven't kept up with inflation, and people are struggling to live in the today. So it's been really hard for a lot of people to set aside any money for their retirement.
You know, Kathleen, this is a great point, and I hear this from friends too, Andrew. You know, yes, I know I'm supposed to save, but I'm barely making ends meet as it is.
It's a very difficult challenge for middle-income families, and we don't deny the difficulty with that. But as a practical matter, if you focus on saving a percentage of your income, and that's the thing, like you haven't seen much income growth, but people have always had a need to save to supplement Social Security, even if that was happening through a traditional employer pension. That was essentially coming – it was a benefit they were provided as part of their compensation. So people still need to find a way to save, even in times where income growth has been slow. And we're talking about a percentage of your income going into an account on a regular basis. And what your goal should be is to try to maintain your standard of living when you retire. So we think that's still doable, even though the challenge has grown with slower income growth.
Well, and you also talk in the book about college costs are also through the roof, and that's cutting into Americans' ability to save for retirement.
It really has been a challenge for people to meet those twin goals of college and retirement. Both of them have shown escalating costs. So we certainly understand why some people feel like they just can't put money away. What we're trying to do is look at ways in which we can move forward. And one of those is to focus on national programs like Social Security and how to shore those programs up to make sure that that base of support doesn't erode.
Okay. And I've got an email that just came in about Social Security, so I'll ask you that after a break, Andrew. Also, why the book so strongly recommends that we all work until age 70. All right, we'll talk about that after a short break and take a lot more of your calls, questions, comments, 1-800-892-6477. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, Andrew Eshtruth is with us. He's co-author of the new book, Falling Short, The Coming Retirement Crisis and What to Do About It. He's in New Hampshire this week speaking about retirement preparation at an event sponsored by the AARP this evening. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Andrew, just before the break, we talked a lot about the decline of private pensions and how 401ks, more individually based, have replaced those. Let's talk about Social Security. And here's an email from Rob, who says, those of us in our 40s and 50s feel like we're in limbo until the government decides what will happen with Social Security. How can we possibly know if we're in good shape for retirement? Rob says, we have a 401k that appears to be on track to supplement our expected Social Security. But what happens if they decide to slash our benefits by 25%? I hope that they stop kicking the can so those of us in our middle age can make some real plans. Rob, thank you for the email. And what do you think, Andrew?
It's an excellent question, a very important point. And this is Social Security is the bedrock program for retirement security in this country. And I certainly understand and sympathize with the frustration that this problem hasn't been solved. It's one that my colleagues and I would like to see solved as well. As you know, the program does face a financial challenge down the road. And you have to do something either on the benefit side or the revenue side. We personally are recommending in the book that the focus be much more on increasing revenues to the program because we think benefits are already reasonably moderate and going down in terms of their ability to support your income. In the past, policymakers have already made changes to reduce benefits. One of those has been to raise the so-called full retirement age from 65 to 67. That's a gradual increase which is taking place. Anyone born in 1960 or later has a full retirement age of 67, not the traditional age of 65. So there have already been some cutbacks in the program. We would like to see those cutbacks stop and the focus much more on bringing more money in to stabilize the program.
Well, and there have been a lot of fixes proposed to Social Security over the years since that big fix in the 1980s that people always talk about. One of them has to do with raising the retirement age. And if you could just clarify, because a lot of people think the retirement age is 62, a lot of people think it's 65. And then I read in your book that the real retirement age is 70. Can you just clarify what that really means?
Yeah, the reason we say 70 is the real retirement age. That's the age in Social Security at which you get your highest monthly benefit. You can retire and claim your benefits any year between 62 and 70. But each year you delay, you get a higher monthly benefit check to make up for the fact that you're claiming for fewer years. So your highest benefit, monthly benefit, is actually at age 70. What they call the full retirement age is really sort of an artifact, and it was a traditional age, and there have been enough policy changes in the program, so it doesn't have a lot of meaning, but it is still used as an anchor point for setting the benefit levels and making adjustments from the benefit levels. But the key thing to remember is that you really get your highest benefit at age 70 on a monthly basis.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think a lot of people might think, oh, I thought the age was 65. So it's not.
It's not. And in fact, it hasn't, even using that old definition, it's not 65 anymore. It's under that old definition, what they call the full retirement age is 66. But again, we're saying that you really maximize your benefit at age 70 because for each year you delay, you get an increase in your monthly benefit check.
Okay. And again, staying in the workforce till age 70 is easier for some folks than others. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But I did want to play a little sound of how presidential candidates are talking about some of these Social Security fixes. And on this topic of raising the retirement age, here's former Florida governor and presidential candidate Jeb Bush speaking about this in Manchester in April.
I think we need to raise the retirement age, not for the people that are already nearing receiving Social Security, already on it, but raise it gradually over a long period of time for people that are just entering the system. And I think we need to do that in relatively short order. And Social Security can be sustained just as it was in the 1980s when Ronald Reagan, Tip O'Neill, Dan Rostenkowski, I guess, was probably in it. Bob Packwood, this group of, you know, people, very conservative, very liberal, and in between, forged consensus on how to sustain Social Security over the long haul.
So, again, Jeb Bush talking about raising the retirement age. And a little bit later, we'll hear some quotes from other presidential candidates on fixes that they might like to see. But what percentage of the workforce, Andrew, could reasonably work until 70, assuming their bosses still want them there?
Well, we think it's a growing percentage every year. I would say probably well more than half of people will be physically able to do that. And you've already seen, I mean, health has generally been improving for people at older ages and actually throughout the age distribution over time. People tend to have less physically demanding jobs than they did in the past. And overall working conditions tend to be better. So we think a large percentage, I would say over half of people would be able to work till 70 if they were their boss was willing to keep them on the job that long.
And I'm sure you've heard folks say, Andrew, you know, working until 70 is discriminatory towards lower income folks who tend to have those more physically demanding jobs. You know, it's easy for a college professor to work until 70, right? You're in an office. But what about those folks who can't physically work until 70? Either because their bodies are just exhausted from work or they have health issues that come up, cancer, whatever. Is this just inherently unfair to them?
Those people are in a tough situation. We recognize that. We know that everybody is not going to be able to work till 70. And so one thing we say is if you can, every additional year you're able to work, puts you in a much better position. So if you were going to retire at 62, the first year you can claim Social Security benefits, and you're now able to make it to 63 or 64, that's going to already put you in a much better position for retirement. So I don't want to overemphasize the age 70. We think of that as a target for people who are healthy, have a job that allows them to do that, and they are in very good stead if they can do that. But a year or two at the margin is also going to do a tremendous amount of good in terms of better preparing you for retirement.
Well, and to that point, have a job that allows them to do that. How willing are employers to make the accommodations that an older worker might need? Maybe they, you know, need to work fewer hours even though they still want to stay in the job, or maybe they need other accommodations. Maybe the employer just doesn't want older workers. We do hear about age discrimination.
It's absolutely true. And we did a survey about 8 years ago on this, asking employers about their perceptions of older workers. And there were some of these, some positives and some negatives. I mean, people do see these older workers as having a reasonable degree of productivity. They're worried about their cost. They're worried about whether they're keeping their skills up. One silver lining we found in these results was that older managers were more likely to have a favorable view toward older workers, the older survey respondents who were the managers. And as the society ages, we're going to have more older people in those managerial roles. And I think they're going to see more value in keeping older workers around.
Well, one more question on this work till 70 issue, because it's being talked about a lot in the policy arena and it's talked about a lot in your book. What would more folks, half the workforce, as you said, staying on the job until 70 mean for millennials, who are said as a generation to be underemployed, not working up to their levels of skill and education?
That's a great question, because a lot of people have this concern that there's some sort of trade-off. Oh, every person that stays on the job an extra year in their 60s, you're going to lose a job for someone in their 20s. It's just not true. If you look at this from a overall national perspective, we did a very comprehensive study on this, looking at the whole U.S. workforce in different time periods, older versus younger workers, and there was no trade-off of this kind. The reason it's not true is that bringing more people into the workforce means that people have more money to spend. When they spend more money, they create more jobs and more demand for goods and services. So just like when there was a large influx of women coming into the U.S. labor force in the 70s, that didn't disrupt jobs for men. There were still jobs for men, and there were jobs for women too. Just like that, you're also going to get a growing economy and a no trade-off between older and younger workers.
Well, another idea that's been talked about, in addition to raising the retirement age, is the idea of means testing Social Security. Just tell us how that might work and what you think about it, Andrew.
So the idea is that if we have a limited amount of resources for Social Security, we could concentrate them more on the people with lower incomes who need the money more.
Right. Like, why does Warren Buffett need a Social Security check? That's what people say.
Absolutely. And so that's a perfectly valid argument. A lot of people have raised that in the last 10, 15 years in the policy debates over Social Security. The one the people who take the other position express concern that if everyone doesn't feel a stake in the program, that you'll end up with a worse program overall. And there is a line that they use that say that poor programs for poor people tend to be poor programs. And the point there is that if you have a large number of people in society who see some stake in a program, they're more likely to support a robust benefit. And when you have a shrinking number of people who see a stake in the program, and the others just feel like they're supporting the people on the poor that are poorer, and they're putting more of their tax money in and not getting anything out of it, there's a concern that those programs will gradually erode.
There's a resentment factor.
Correct.
Well, what do you think of that? I mean, sounds good philosophically, but when we're talking dollars and cents, if there are waning amounts of dollars, can we really afford to hold on to that philosophy?
I think the better way to think about Social Security is that if you see further cutbacks in the program for anybody, and one thing to note is that the Warren Buffetts of the world, they're not getting unlimited benefits from the program because their earnings are capped at around $118,000 in terms of the benefits that they receive are based on earnings which are way lower than the earnings that they actually make. So their benefits are not these enormous benefits. They're not that much more than, say, a small-town doctor might get from the program who's also paying in the maximum amount to Social Security. So I think it's more important to think about bringing in revenue to support the system, because as you cut everybody's benefits back, some of them are going to have to scramble and save somewhere else. So if we reduce benefits for professional people that were using Social Security as a base for their support, they're just going to have to save more on their own too.
Well, again, this has been talked about a lot on the presidential campaign trail. And here's New Jersey governor and likely presidential candidate Chris Christie speaking about this idea of possibly means testing Social Security. Christie speaking in Manchester a couple months ago.
Do we really believe that the wealthiest Americans need to take from younger, hardworking Americans to receive what, for most of them, is a modest monthly Social Security check? Now, I say no, and I propose a modest means test that only affects those with non-Social Security income of over $80,000 a year and phases out Social Security payments entirely for those that have $200,000 a year in retirement income. Think about how much money you have $200,000 in retirement income.
Again, that's New Jersey governor, likely presidential candidate Chris Christie, talking about what we're talking about this hour, retirement security in America, some of the proposals out there to make it more secure. Our guest is Andrew Eshtruth. He's at Boston College, and he's co-author of the new book, Falling Short, The Coming Retirement Crisis and What to Do About It. And Andrew, back to our listeners, and let's go to Lee. Go ahead, Lee, you're on the air.
Hi. You talked about means testing, Social Security benefits already are means tested. Back in 1983, they started taxing. They started making Social Security benefits subject to taxation. The thresholds that were set back then have never been adjusted for inflation. In 2014, Social Security took back something like $21.4 billion of benefits via the taxation of benefits. I found another figure that 66% of those people who showed Social Security benefits on the tax return, 66% of those had to report it as taxable income. I've looked at whether those thresholds should ever be adjusted for inflation, which they haven't been in over 30 years. And what I find is people want to make 100% of benefits taxable.
Okay.
And I find in my case, the more successful you are in having provided for other income through retirement plans, the more chance, more likely it is you're going to lose some benefits.
Yeah. Lee,
in my
thank
case,
you.
every $100 of other benefits I get, I have to put $85 of my benefit of my Social Security in my taxable column.
Well, and it's frustrating because people feel like they're entitled to that check in its entirety. Is it shocking to people that they actually have to pay taxes on this?
I think it's a surprise, and it's a terrific point that the caller brings up because a lot of people aren't aware of it. And when this started, and you very rightly point out that these thresholds for taxation have not been adjusted since 1983, and so gradually more and more people are finding that they need to pay taxes on a portion of their Social Security benefits. It started out in the mid-80s, only about 10 or 15% of people were affected by this provision. Today, again, as the caller rightly points out, it's about there's roughly 35 to 40% of people in this position now, and it's going up a little bit every year because people are gradually going above those thresholds, which have never changed for inflation since the mid-1980s.
Something else I'd like you to explain to us, Andrew, the idea of a cap, and you touched on this earlier, but just remind us how that works. We talked about it when we talked about, does Warren Buffett really need a Social Security check? Remind us how that cap works, because a lot of people say, you know, just raise the income cap and that'll fix Social Security. Go ahead.
Yes. So people pay Social Security tax on their earnings up to a capped amount. Currently, that's about $118,000. So above $118,000, people don't pay any Social Security taxes.
So it's all yours.
That's right. But they also don't get extra benefits for the earnings they make above that amount. When the Social Security Administration calculates their benefits, which are based on their career earnings, they don't give you credit for any earnings that you got above those threshold amounts, that capped amount. And as Laura, as you point out, one policy proposal has been, what if we raise that cap? That will capture more income. And there's a good public policy reason to consider for that as well. That cap, the percentage of earnings covered by that cap has actually gone down over time because, harking back to an earlier caller, we've seen very little wage growth in the middle of the income distribution. Most of the wage growth has been coming at the top end of the income distribution. What that's done over time is that fewer and fewer people more people are finding themselves in a position where they're not paying taxes on all of their income.
Because they're below the cap.
Because when their earnings go above the cap, because the wage growth has occurred above that level.
I see.
So more earnings, I should say, in the economy overall are escaping taxation in that sense.
Well,
are
and
not
that's,
being taxed.
That's a point brought out by another presidential candidate who we'll hear from, Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders, running as a Democrat. He was speaking on the Diane Rehm show earlier this month, and he talked about that as well.
What do we have to do? In my view, I will fight as hard as I can to resist any cuts to Social Security. But furthermore, we have to expand Social Security benefits because many seniors and disabled people can't make it on $12,000, $13,000, $14,000 a year. How do you do that? Very simply. Right now, multimillionaires are paying the same amount of money into the Social Security Trust Fund as somebody making $118,000. If you lift the cap, and you don't have to start at $119,000, you begin at $250,000. If you do that, Social Security will be solvent until 2061, and we can expand benefits.
Okay, so again, that's Bernie Sanders speaking on the Diane Rehm Show about this last idea on Social Security. People have talked about this for a long time, Andrew, but it doesn't seem to really change.
Overall, the problem with Social Security?
Well, no, more specifically, this raise the cap. I've heard so many people talk about this.
It polls really well, too. So that might not surprise you, but if you ask people to pick from a list of options for fixing the Social Security long-term financing challenge, this scores very highly among people. They're very interested in this idea of raising the cap, and that's not surprising. And you can get a fair amount of money from raising the cap. You can't, unless you don't give people any credit for the earnings they put into the system when you raise the cap, you don't actually get 100% of the solution from raising the cap. You can get 30, 40, 50% of the solution from raising the cap. The reason it hasn't happened, it's part of the broader conflict and disagreement over how to solve Social Security, which usually requires some sort of give and take by both sides to come together. So we haven't seen that happen yet. If we do, I wouldn't be surprised if raising the cap was part of that solution.
All right, coming up, more of your questions and comments about retirement, what Andrew Eshtruth calls the coming retirement crisis in his book and what to do about it. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, how ready are you for retirement? We're sitting down with Andrew Eshtruth. He's Communications Director at Boston College's Center for Retirement Research. He is the co-author of the new book, Falling Short, The Coming Retirement Crisis and What to Do About It. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. You know, Andrew, one of the big themes that keeps coming up in this book is Americans in general are pretty poor savers. Why is that?
Well, some of the issues we've touched on before is people don't see slack in their budgets and they haven't seen a lot of income growth. And saving is hard. People don't know how much they're supposed to save. They don't know where they should put their money. So it's not something where typically, even though people could go down to their bank and open up an IRA, they tend not to do that. So what we found just by looking at the data on how much income and assets people have is that they save very little except in employer-sponsored arrangements. When they get into a situation where money is kind of automatically taken out of their paycheck or where they can have the opportunity to contribute to something their employer can explain to them, that's the vehicle in which people save. And so one of our concerns is that a lot of people don't even have access to a 401k. At any given time in the private sector, about half the workforce is not participating in any kind of retirement plan, 401k or a traditional pension at all. And we're worried about those people, and we need a separate solution to close the gap for them.
What might that solution look like?
So there are a number of things bubbling up, both at the federal and the state level. Lately, we've been really interested in these state initiatives because states seem to be trying to take this into their own hands and saying, is there a way that we can get low-cost saving plans in place in the small businesses in our state that aren't going to require those businesses to match? They're just going to be payroll deduction saving plans for the employees. And some states have kind of charged ahead here. Nobody's actually implemented one yet, but we actually are doing some work for the state of Connecticut right now that's looking into this. California has expressed interest in this. Illinois has, a few other states. I think in New Hampshire, there was a debate on this type of issue earlier this year. So we've actually been encouraged because there hasn't been a lot of legislative progress at the federal level on any issue to see that the states, those laboratories of democracy, are starting to bubble up and try to take on this challenge themselves.
Well, here's an email from Todd to that effect, Andrew. He says, can you please speak to the various burdens on small employers related to choosing and maintaining a retirement plan? Also, how states could help small businesses help their employees save for retirement? So that's what you just talked about. My question is, though, again, as people move around from job to job, mm-hmm. how does a small business keep up with that? Is it really worth it for them to invest in someone who's only going to be there for 5 years?
So the idea here is that you make the cost to the small employer extraordinarily minimal in these cases. Essentially, what they're doing under these sort of state saving plans that people have talked about is that they're just providing payroll deduction from part of the employee's wages. They, the employer, unlike in a 401k, are probably not going – they're not going to be matching.
But at least the employee, him or herself, is putting a little aside.
And that speaks directly to this problem people have with saving. Now we've got someone in a situation where it's really easy for them to save. And that we've seen success even with people in moderate and low incomes. You see success at saving when they're in these kinds of arrangements.
Well, I'm glad you said moderate and low incomes because you do hear about, you know, you're going to need, we're told, gargantuan amounts of money to make it through retirement. And so to the average person, you know, if I can only afford to save $100 a month, that doesn't even seem worth it.
Absolutely. I understand that it's very daunting, and that's one obstacle to saving, is that people hear it and they tune out and they say, I'm going to do the best I can, but I can't even get started. So the important thing to remember is that any amount you put away for retirement is going to improve your situation when you get there. And the dollar amount, not everybody has to save $1 million, $2 million, the things you see on the ads sometimes. It depends on how much income you make. And our focus is on getting people to a point where they can still maintain the standard of living they had when they were working when they retire. So obviously for someone making $30,000 a year, the amount they're going to have to save for retirement is much lower than a professional person who might be making six figures.
Well, and here's the other question I have, and this often comes up. You know, when we talk about saving for retirement, the vehicles available these days are less secure. They're mostly, you know, when you talk about 401ks and IRAs, those are invested in stocks, which can go up and can go down. We're just recovering from a big crash. So it doesn't feel like traditional savings, which felt sort of secure and you knew they were going to be there.
You hit the nail on the head. You have to take some risk in order to get a higher return. And you always are going to face a risk when you're in the equity markets, in the stock market. But over time, generally, you're going to want a balanced portfolio. Most people and most companies that have these automatic 401k plans will default people into a balanced investment portfolio that has some stocks and some bonds. And over time, 5, 10, 15, 20, 25 years is shown to invariably produce a higher rate of return than staying in super safe investments. But if you're more comfortable and you want to start out that way, you should have the choice to stay in very conservative investments. And in fact, the President Obama has a program called MyRA, that they're trying to get employers to take up and offer. It's similar to these savings account ideas I was just talking about, to provide small employers with an opportunity or large employers who don't have a plan for their employees to save. And one of the things they designed this program to do was to only put the first $15,000 in extraordinarily safe investments where you're not going to lose any money.
So at least you have something
that's right
there. Because again, people all have seen several crashes and might feel uncomfortable about putting their life's nest egg into the stock market. It's all sort of personal preference and comfort level. Let's go to Randolph, and Gary's on the phone from Randolph. Hi, go ahead, Gary.
Yeah, Laura, thanks for having me on the call,
sure,
the show. Yeah, you guys are starting to talk a little bit of what my question was. You know, Social Security is kind of like a guaranteed pension. And I'm just curious as to how your speaker feels about annuities. I've got a friend who's been talking to me about those. I'm 61, 62, getting close to retirement. They sound like a good deal. You invest your money with someone, or you give your money to someone, and they will invest it, and then they guarantee you a percent based on a monthly income, kind of like you would have a pension from years ago.
Okay. Gary, thank you very much for the call. Go ahead, Andrew.
Gary, that's an excellent question. Yes, we have thought quite a lot about annuities at our center at Boston College, and we think they do have a place for consideration for retirees in what to do with at least a portion of their nest egg. And the reason is, you've kind of alluded to, is that Social Security is going to be replacing less pre-retirement income than it did for our parents or grandparents' generation. And you want to look for ways to have a predictable stream of income in retirement. And one way to do that is to go to an insurance company with a portion of your savings and buy an annuity.
So that's what an annuity is.
Exactly. The insurance company will take that. They will say, okay, I now have your part of your nest egg. In exchange, every month until you die, I'm going to give you a payout. And so you have a predictable stream. And so we think that's definitely something to consider. I know that some people are concerned that they think the cost of annuities might be a little high if they're in their 60s. If you're concerned about that, another way to think of an annuity is you can buy something called an advanced life deferred annuity. And all you're doing, it's like a time delay annuity. Instead of kicking in immediately, it kicks in when you're 80 or 85. And if you put some money in that, you're guaranteeing yourself protection against living a very long time. So in the meantime, you can draw down your assets in whatever way you wish, knowing that if you hit age 80 or 85, all of a sudden you're going to get a stream of guaranteed income kicking in. And so one thing about that is these products are much less expensive, obviously, because they're not paying out for as many years. So you don't have to put as much money into this kind of product as you would to an immediate annuity.
So is the benefit for the insurance company doing this? It's almost, correct me if I'm wrong, please, Andrew, they are sort of acting like the employer used to with traditional pensions. They're kind of playing on the stock market, seeing if they can get more money out of your money by making strategic investments. In the meantime, you say, fine, go ahead, do that, but guarantee me, you know, X dollars a month.
That's essentially what's happening, is they're pooling all the money from everybody who buys annuities. They're making guaranteed payouts based on an agreement at the time you buy the product.
All right, let's take another call. Thank you very much for that one, Gary. And Doreen's in Concord. Hi, Doreen. Go ahead. You're on the exchange.
Thank you so much for taking my call. My question is if your author made any reference to taking your Social Security at an earlier age. When I figured out mine, it would have taken me 13 years before I would start losing money.
And Doreen, how old are you?
I'm 67.
67. And are you retired?
Yes, I am. Yeah. Both my birth parents both died at 80, so I decided to take it early.
And what age did you retire?
Right before 65.
Okay. All right. So she waited at least until 65, not going to that 62 benchmark. Go ahead, Andrew.
It's a very important and personal decision about when to claim Social Security. And as the caller points out, one thing that a lot of people end up considering this is they sort of think about it a little bit strategically in terms of, you know, if I take it early, how long will I have to live before I hit this what some people refer to as a break-even point? And let me explain that very quickly. So the reason that you get a higher benefit for delaying Social Security is that they want to make it fair for the average person. They base this, the actuaries base this on how long the average person will live. And so if someone takes it at 62 versus 65, the person at 62 is going to get Social Security for if they live the same amount of time as the person claiming at 65. Let's say they both are going to expect to live to 80. They have to give the 62-year-old a little less to be fair, because the person claiming at 65 is getting benefits for fewer years. So your caller is referring to trying to figure out, based on her own life expectancy or those of her parents, when was a good age to claim. It's a very personal decision. Anybody, as long as you have thought carefully about what you want to do, that's the most important thing in making that decision. 70 is not going to be the right age for everybody. 62 is not going to be the right age for everybody. That's one benefit of having the flexibility to claim in that 8-year time period.
Well, and that was your point earlier, is that you're not saying every American absolutely should retire at 70. Obviously, that's not an option that a lot of people can choose or want to choose. But your overall goal, Andrew, is to get people to think about, how about another year or maybe two more years? Not all the way to 70, but a little bit longer.
Yes. And part of that, too, is there's another important thing that Social Security provides for married couples. So if you're the higher earner in a two-earner couple, or in a one-earner couple, if you're the main earner and you die, your spouse will then essentially inherit your benefit. And so even if you were to die unfortunately, prematurely, you know, after a few years, your spouse will get that benefit for the rest of, say, her lifespan. So if one person lives to 80 but the other lives to 90, there's some benefit in delaying Social Security so that the person living to 90 gets a higher monthly check.
Well, to this point again about working till 70, and I think we've touched a, a nerve here, Andrew. Here's Wally in Dover who says, I have a relatively high income right now, but my job is extremely demanding, 60 to 70 hours per week. Overnight work, a minimum requirement of 100 hours per year, ongoing training, and a daily high level of cognitive demand. Wow, Wally. He says, what do you think about a, quote, retirement job starting at about age 60? And you talk about this in the book, Andrew, you know, that some people think, okay, I'll work till 70, but I'll downshift, I'll work part-time, I'll work fewer hours. I'm tired, I don't have the ability to work, you know, a full 40, 50 hours a week, or like Wally, a lot more. What about his question, a, quote, retirement job?
I think that downshifting the retirement job notion is very attractive to a lot of people. Actually, I think it's maybe attractive to me later in my life. And it can work for people. But we're a little hesitant to be very gung-ho on these kinds of jobs because I don't think it works for a lot of people. And it may sound easier than it looks to make this work well. So we generally encourage people to stay more in kind of a full-time career job as long as they can. That allows them generally to earn a little bit more income. It's generally easier to find employment if you stick with an employer you've been with for a long time. Can be risky to go out and switch jobs when you're in your 60s. So that's something to consider. But taking that all into account, if you find a good position for downshifting and you otherwise feel like you're going to be well prepared, again, that's a personal decision. And for some people, that could work out quite well.
And if your employer still wants you, again, there's that other point.
Absolutely. And this might be a reason why some people go off and work on their own, too. You know, they switch to one person, you know, start their own businesses.
Well, here's two comments from Twitter from Fran and Frank, both asking about where the heck to put savings, given that interest rates are at rock bottom levels. Fran says many would like to put their cash in savings accounts, but the interest is so low. When does the Fed move on this? And then Frank also says interest rates on savings accounts need to rise. Where does a young person save? I remember starting a savings account years and years ago, and you know, you got like 5, 6, 7%, so it seemed a decent place to park your money. Now it's almost not worth it.
No, it's always worth it to save.
Even if the interest rates are 2%?
Even if the interest rates are 2%, it's worth it to save. So, I mean, there are a couple different answers here. One is that you can consider putting some of your money in the equity markets. It seems like there was a little tension there on the part of the comments you read. Some people may not want to do that in the stock
Stocks,
market.
Stocks, yeah, it's risky.
So you can do that with some of your money. Another option is when you're young, every dollar you have is going to have a long period of time to grow in different economies. So it's always better to save than not save.
Well, and to that that point you made about when you're young, my last question for you, Andrew, is for people listening who may be, you know, just starting out their working years in their 20s, early 30s, what steps should a young adult listening right now take when retirement seems like a million years away?
So the most important thing, and I got this advice on my first job out of school, which was as soon as you can join, if your company offers a 401k plan, sometimes there's a waiting period. In some companies, you have to be there a year before you can join. If your company offers a plan, join it as soon as you can. Put in at least enough to get the full employer match, because if you don't, you're leaving salary on the table.
It's free money, basically.
That's free money, basically, from your employer that they're putting into your retirement savings. So that's very important. If you can, you should inch that up over time. We find that for someone kind of a medium earner should be putting maybe 10 to 15% of their salary, shooting for that as a goal to put away. If you start early and you work later, you need to put less away because you have a longer period of work life over which to accumulate your savings.
How about for that 40 to 50 to close to 60 something who's listening? What's the one step that they should take?
Well, for them, you can save a little bit more, but the biggest kick you're going to get from saving more is reducing your standard of living today. If you get used to a little bit lower standard of living, it will be easier once you adjust into retirement. You won't need as much money set aside to maintain a lower standard of living. You should also focus on what you can get from working longer, the benefits for your retirement security of that approach.
That work till 70 mantra again. Andrew, thank you so much. It was nice to meet you.
Thank you, Laura.
That's Andrew Eshtruth. Again, he's co-author of the book Falling Short, The Coming Retirement Crisis and What to Do About It. Andrew is communications director at Boston College's Center for Retirement Research. He's speaking about retirement preparation at an event sponsored by the AARP this evening. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Producers are Faith Meixel and Jason Moon. Our intern is Noah Bunnell. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Knoy.